coming out of the turn. Check the period now by 5 lengths. Miguel in second, Iron Maiden third. They're coming to the 8th pole. Check the period by 5 lengths. They pass the 8th pole of the mile, 1:35. Check the period all by himself. America's Super Horse, Don Churchard up, 50 yards to come. Check the period by 7. Check the period 8 lengths. And Miguel, Iron Maiden is third.
Welcome to Equisport Radio, your VIP pass to the world of horse racing.
Down the stretch they come, cast speed digging in at the rail.
Les Salzman takes you inside the gate, behind the scenes, to the heart of horse racing. Equisport Radio. Get tied on.
Hey, and welcome to the show. This is Les Salzman, and along with me is my trusty sidekick, Scott Miller. We're right here at the finish line at Sunshine Meadows in beautiful Delray Beach, Florida. We're enjoying the warmth. Great morning, huh, Scott?
Great morning. I think we're going to have a jolly time today.
And you can see Scott's in rare form this morning. He's been excited about this show, as I am. Two of the great guys in racing, and two of the guys that both Scott and I have looked up to as we've gone through this industry for the last 40 years. Leroy Jolly, who's just an incredible guy as well as trainer. One of the most interesting people I know, and the accomplishments that this guy has done over the years, the Hall of Fame horses he's trained, and he himself a Hall of Famer. And right after Leroy, one of the most fun guys in the industry, Jack Van Berg. So we've got a great show. Scott, I'm looking forward to it. How about you?
Oh, I can't wait.
Okay, let's get tied on and get started after this break.
Now, I'm a man who's known for his pleasures. These two I train, and this one I drink. Light beer from Miller. It's got a third less calories than their regular beer, and it's less filling. But what I love best is the way it tastes. What a pleasure. Right, guys? Am I a trainer, or am I a trainer?
Light beer from Miller. Everything you always wanted in a beer, and less.
Norris's Theatrical is third. Cordero content to sit in fourth toward the inside, with Manila fourth by three parts of a length. On the outside, Rivlia is fifth. At the rail, the Roan Colt Sherrood with Vin Kai is sixth at this point. Then three back to Explosive Darling, and Glaros is the trailer as they straighten away down the backstretch. It's Forlitano and Gary Bays in front by half a length. Theatrical between horses, Spellbound on the outside, those three tightly bunched, with Manila right there in fourth and Theatrical on the outside fifth. Sherrood at the rail, saving ground in sixth. Two and a half back, that's Explosive Darling and Glaros trails. Down the backstretch after a slow quarter in 48 and two fifths and three quarters in 1:13 and three. Forlitano on the inside hangs tough, but there goes Theatrical now taking command. Theatrical off to lead it by three parts of a length. Forlitano is second. Cordero looks for racing room between horses with Manila on the outside. Rivlia with Chris McCarran is on the move as they move to the top of the stretch. Here comes Manila, boldly moving through on the inside. Cordero finds room, cuts the corner and takes command. The champ is back in the lead, and Manila has the lead by two and a half lengths. Pintai puts Sherrood in gear at the rail as the Roan Colt takes second, and down the stretch they come. Manila draws off to lead it by three. Pintai giving chase with Sherrood in second. Theatrical is third, coming to the wire in the Budweiser Arlington Million. It's Manila grabbing it by two and a half lengths. Sherrood was second by four.
Capodia, the middle of the racetrack. Chocolate One is right there between horses third. Mixed Emotions four wide on the first turn, followed by Gone West, then Pleasant Variety, Marine Command, Sage Ground along the inside, and three and a half back to the trailer, KC's Best Turn. It's Capodia on the lead, racing away from the rail in front by two. On the inside, Chocolate One, second by a head, Mixed Emotions third. There goes Gone West, moving on the outside. He was not up front early, but he is fourth on the outside, two and a half off the leader as they straighten away for the run down the back stretch. First quarter, 23 and 3 on the muddy track. the podium, Cordero, in front by one, with Chocolate One in second by a length and a quarter. Gone West bides time in third, four lengths farther back. Here comes Gulp, squeezing through along the inside. Marine Command on the outside. The long shot is fifth, as Mixed Emotions drops back into sixth. Then Pleasant Variety, and Casey's Best Turn remains the trailer. Around the far turn they go, and it's still Capote. He's the one to catch. He's in front three parts of the length. Chocolate One, closer than usual, is right there in second, and Gone West is third. Gulp saving ground along the inside fourth, and Marine Command with a big move is right there fifth as the field moves past the quarter pole. Capote, the front runner. Here's Gone West on the outside. Here's Gulp at the rail.
Tremendous finish by Gulch with jockey Jose Santos aboard. We talked about Santos in Florida, who has moved up in the last couple of years to become one of the outstanding jockeys in the country. No question, he gave Gulch a perfect ride today. Remember, that'll be a photo, very unofficial, but it looked like Gulch to us.
It looked as though Gulch has learned his lessons well. Leroy Jolly has been trying to teach him to relax, to come from off the pace. And today, he passed his exams with flying colors. He laid back off those early fractions set by the three other top favorites, and he was the only one straggling back. And when he made his move, he managed to wear down Gone West through the stretch and win by a nose for his first victory beyond 7/8 of a mile.
Okay, let's have another look at the stretch run.
And at this point, Gone West has taken over the lead from Capote, who fades there, and he's
off the pace, and Metal Star takes the lead and makes it easily by a length and a half. Daily Spin is now second, and Risen Colony is third, and Light Light will do her running from off the pace today. She is six lengths off the easy lead of Metal Star. Metal Star dictating her own easy pace here. 24 and 4/5 seconds for the opening quarter. Advantage, Metal Star. She leads by three. Daily's Pin is racing second. Risen Colony is third. Corey Nakatani is still unhurried with Light Light. He's still about 5.5 lengths off the lead. Metal Star is just cruising down the backstretch. It's a dawdling pace here in the Mother Goose. Daily Spin is second, and now Light Light begins to roll as they approach the far turn. The half, they're walking 49 2/5 seconds, and now the tempo quickening as they enter the far turn. Metal Star still holding the lead, and Light Light moves to engage her with a half mile to run. Risen Colony down on the inside, racing third, and Daily Spin is fourth. It's Metal Star trying to go the distance now, and Light Light confronts her head to head with 3 furlongs to run. And here's the race we've been waiting for. Metal Star in front by a head. Light Light, they're moving inseparably as they come to the top of the stretch, pulling away from the field. Metal Star is tested here. Light Light is right at her neck. They're still inseparable as they come down the stretch here at Belmont Park. Metal Star fully extended. Light Light surging on the outside. Light Light ahead in front of the eighth pole. Metal Star is coming back. What a thriller as they come down to the finish. Metal Star determined. Light Light unwavering. Here's the finish, and it is!
Second, Jacqueline Plugman. Third, Super Moment. The fourth post position is Degenerate John. And then comes the 12 horse, Tonka Walken, in the fifth hole. In the sixth hole is Rock Hill Native.
Looks good, with, Joe.
Yes, he does look
he
good.
He really looks good.
And the kids seem composed up in the jocks room. Gold Stage was lathering as he went in with Cordero up.
He is
and
really
then up. Rumbo, the seven horse in the ninth hole.
It looks well. Rumbo really looks cool and collected.
And the 13 horse, the other field horse, the late entry, Hazard Duke. There is Rumba, now going in, the ninth hole. The 8 horse is the much-talked-about filly, Genuine Risk, Jacinto Vazquez, polished rider.
Plug Nickel looked well, too, Howard. Very cold.
All right, withholding goes in, so do the others. Up to Dave Johnson for the call.
They're all in line, and they're off. Gold stage from between horses, getting the early lead. Then toward the inside, it's Rock Hill Native second out in the middle of the racetrack. Execution's Reason with Plug Nickel from between horses, passing the stands for the first time. On the outside, Execution's Reason has the lead by a head. Plug Nickel between horses. Rock Hill Native on the inside, third. Three of them across the track, battling for the early lead. Then it's Withholding on the outside, fourth. Gold Stage back to fifth between horses. Bold and Rolling inches up on the inside. After that, it's Genuine Risk. Gap of two lengths to Jacqueline Puckman. Degenerate John on the inside. Super Moment. Hazard Duke. And then the trailers. Tonka walking on the inside. Rumbo is 13th as they move on to the backstretch. Rock Hill Native leads at three parts of length. On the outside, Plug Nickel second ahead. And Bold and Ruling surprisingly on the rail. Now takes the second spot. Plug Nickel on the outside back to third. From between horses, Gold Stage is fourth. Execution's Reason on the outside is fifth. Degenerate John on the rail is next. Then it's the filly, Genuine Risk. A gap of three lengths back to the next flank. After that, it's Super Moment on the outside. Jacqueline Kluckman from between horses. Hazard Duke is next. Rumbo on the inside, Withholding. And the trailer now, Tonka Wonkin 13th. And on to the far turn after they pass the half mile in a slow 48 seconds. On the inside, here comes Bold and Ruling charging up to challenge Rock Hill Native on the outside. Plug Nickel is right there, and there goes Genuine Risk. Now they're tightly bunched as they move to the top of the stretch, and Genuine Risk on the outside takes the lead. It's Genuine Risk in front, 3 points of length. Rock Hill Native on the inside is second, and Plug Nickel third. Here comes Jacqueline Tuckman in the middle of the track, and down the stretch they come. It's Genuine Risk in front, 3 points of length. Here comes Jacqueline Tuckman up to be second. Rumbo in the middle of the racetrack is flying. Rock Hill Native drops back. They're in the final furlong. It's Genuine Risk, and she's Genuine. Here comes Rumbo on the outside. Genuine Risk is going to win it. Genuine Risk by one. Rumbo on the outside second. After that, it was Jacqueline Tuckman finishing third, and Super Moment fourth. A tremendous feat. The first filly to run in the Run for the Roses in 21 years, and only the second filly in history to win this mile and a quarter classic. Regret won it in 1915, and Genuine Risk, trained by the outstanding conditioner Leroy Jolly and ridden by Jacinto Vasquez, who took foolish pleasure to the winner's circle after the Kentucky Derby. Genuine Risk in 2 minutes and 2 seconds. Now back to Jim McKay.
And they're all in line. Zero. General Assembly on the inside. King Green on the outside in second. General Assembly does have the early lead. King Green does move up on the outside. Then it's Private Account, Steady Growth, Devona, Dale Smartin, and Screen King. Past the stands now for the first time. General Assembly has the rail and the lead by a head. King Green is moving up on the outside, right there in second by two. Private Account between horses in third by a half length, and Devona Dale on the rail is fourth. Steady Growth on the outside, fifth, and Smartin and Screen King around the clubhouse turn. The first quarter in 23 and three. They are moving with a quick pace. It's General Assembly now leading by a length and a half. King Green is second by a length and a half. It's Devona Dale on the rail now in third and gaining ground. And then Private Account back into fourth down the back stretch. General Assembly leads by 2.5. King Green on the outside retains second by a length. Devona Dale is third. Smartin moves up on the rail a closer fourth. And Private Account, Steady Growth, and Screen King down the back stretch the half in 47 and 3. General Assembly has the lead, maintains a three-length lead. On the outside now is Smartin into second by three. Then King Green back into third. Devona Dale has lost some ground in fourth, and it's Private Account and Screen King around the far turn. General Assembly has the lead by three. It's Martin in second by 6 lengths, and on the outside, King Green. On the inside is Steady Growth and Devona Dale into the stretch. General Assembly has the lead still by four. It's Martin in second by 6. Private Account on the rail is third. On the outside, King Green, then Devona Dale, the filly, approaching the 16th pole. General Assembly extending to an 8-length lead, and Martin is second. General Assembly in front. And under the wire, an easy winner, General Assembly, with Smartan second and Private Account was third. The time on the board, a new stakes and track record here at Saratoga.
Leroy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm sitting here in sunny Ocala, and it's very nice. I'm sitting out in outside. I hope the car's going by. Don't interrupt. But anyway, it's a very nice day here.
I'm sure we're going to be fine, and I'm glad that we got a chance to talk on the radio. You and I have been buddies for a number of years and always wanted to get you on the show because you've accomplished so much in the sport, and while doing that, you've become such a well-rounded person, a great guy to be around. But you grew up, you were born in Hot Springs way back when, I'm not going to embarrass you when, and your dad was a great horseman himself.
Yes, he trained for a long time, had a bunch of good horses, and basically I was born into what I'm doing, and I've never done anything else.
Was it something that you just wanted to do, or you happened to be there, or how did it feel?
Well, of course, you know, having a father for a horse trainer, from very early on, you know, I would go to the barn and hang around and ride the pony. Even when I was very small, he had an old pony named Bill. I think everybody's pony was named Bill. And I would go to the barn and ride the pony. And it's something I grew up with. And, you know, all my early memories of my life have been around the racetrack. So it was just a natural situation to become a horse trainer.
So now your dad was a great trainer, but he also had a great eye for buying a horse as well. And I've noticed you at the sales, you do as well. Do you think you got some of that from him?
Well, it was certainly great to learn with somebody that was very good at it. Very few people, he bought Dark Star as a yearling for $6,500. The horse that was the only horse that ever beat Native Dancer when he won the Derby. So we really had three Derby winners in our family.
And just to jump ahead a little bit, and it must have been really rewarding to you in 1975 when you won the Derby. And your dad was up there in years, and how did that feel?
Well, it was a great feeling. It was something that he always wanted to accomplish. He, of course, he bought Dark Star as a baby, raced him at two, but he didn't have him at three, so he missed that. But it was something that, you know, you grew up in a family of people around the horses, and the talk was always about the Derby and major races. So it was a great thrill, and he was a wonderful little horse. He won seven races as a two-year-old, and he had only been defeated once when he ran in the Derby, so it was a great great thing.
Now, growing up, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have two older sisters, and we grew up kind of in the back seat of our father's car, traveling around America, and it was certainly different traveling in those days. There were no interstate highway system. It took about 3 days to drive from New York to Miami, and you know, you went through all kinds of little towns and red lights. So life has certainly changed in the last 60 years.
So, you know, as so many children of horsemen, you know, you're in one place for the summertime, another place for the wintertime. How was school and all that kind of stuff for you?
Well, of course, in those days, the race meets were not long race meets like we have today. And I guess the longest span we spent in one place was in Miami in the wintertime, and went to school there. But it was not an unusual thing to go to three, four different schools in the school year. And my sister, the one who's slightly older than I am, she and I went to school in Tennessee for a while. We went to a two-room school that had, I was in the fourth grade, and my classroom went from one to six, and hers went from 7 to 12. So we we kind of experienced a lot of different things.
Now, your dad was born in Tennessee, right? Is that where most of the family's from?
Yeah. He was one of 16 children in Nashville, Tennessee. And he ran away from home when he was 11 and made his life on the racetrack the rest of his life.
And got you there as well. So,
well, I kind of followed him around.
Now you started training at an early age. You were, what, 18, 19 years old when you first started training?
I think I was a little more than 20. Actually, okay. I'd been working on the racetrack all my life, you know, when school was out. I always worked for my father, walking hots or whatever it took, raking up, whatever. You know, whatever needed to be done. And I went to the University of Miami for a year, and I left there in 1957 and went to work. So I was 19 when I went to work, and I won a race the following February when I was 20.
I didn't realize you went to University of Miami. I lasted there a year also. So we've got that in common. And the rest of the world called on both of us, right?
Right, right. Well, I went there when they had just moved to South Miami, and most of the university was all portable buildings, and a lot of Korean War vets were there. So it was an interesting time.
Now, let me ask you this. While you were at University of Miami, did you sneak over to Hialeah?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I worked on the weekends for my father then, and Hialeah was absolutely the most wonderful place in the world. If you liked horse racing, and even if you didn't, it was a great place to go.
You know, it's still such a beautiful plant. Matter of fact, my wife just did a painting of Hialeah, and it's such a great place. It's a shame that we don't have racing there now, but when I was a kid, when you were a kid, boy, there was no safer place in the world, was there?
Kind of the cradle of racing, certainly in our country. And, you know, people bought new clothes and new outfits to wear to the races. It was a very, very upscale thing. And there were days when they had maiden races when you couldn't wait to get to the races to see the maidens run. And it was really, really the greatest racing that I think I ever experienced.
And then you went to the New York circuit and made, I mean, you just created havoc there the way you were winning races.
Tell
me a little bit about that.
We didn't have a huge number of horses, but we were lucky enough that the numbers that we had were very good. And, of course, the New York season in those days ended around Thanksgiving, and it started around the 1st of April. So it wasn't a year-round thing the way it is now. And when it closed, everybody came down to Florida. A few people went to California. But racing in New York was a great thing. And it was pretty much certainly the most prestigious area of racing in America.
When you came to New York, and you said you didn't have a lot of horses, at the pinnacle of the jolly era, about how many did you have in the barn?
Well, our barn at Belmont had only 21 stalls. And we would fill those stalls, and then we'd have maybe three or four more that we kind of hustled a stall here and there for. So basically 24, 25 was the most we had.
You know, and that's so... so refreshing to hear, because right now, you know, you're hearing of trainers with 220, 240 horses. And I know, as a young trainer and even before that, watching your horses, every horse came out of the barn, you know, carrying good flesh, you know, looked good, acted good, because you had the time to spend with them. And I think that was the difference.
Well,
am I correct?
It was a different era. You know, in those days, all of our babies would go to Hialeah Park for the winter. And there was just some magical thing that once we got those horses down there and got them clipped and got them on the racetrack, that they absolutely did wonderful. They looked great, and obviously some of them could run, and they ran great races. So it was a wonderful year-round program. Different sites, but in all the places they went, the horses did very well.
Well, and one of the things, though, that really impresses me about you is the races that you won. Okay, some guys are good two-year-old trainers. Some guys are good turf trainers. Some guys are good filly trainers. When I look at the major races that you won and the horses that you won with, I can't figure out which one you're good at, but you're good at a bunch of them. You know, you have horses like Manila and Genuine Risk and all those horses, but they all do different stuff. What's the secret to that?
Well, the main thing is you got to get the horse. I think it's if you get a horse that obviously is better on the grass, then you got to go that way. You have to let them tell you which way you want to go. And we had a really wonderful filly that we bought named What a Summer. And we tried her. She had been a great filly in Maryland, and her owner died, and Bert and Diana Firestone bought her. And she was so tough to train because she looked like a greyhound bus. She was gray and huge and very tough. So we tried training her, and nobody could gallop her. She was so tough. So we finally started ponying her. And the only time we put the tack on her was when we worked her. And she became the champion sprinter even over the colts.
So you won the fall highway with her, right?
I think she won it twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so she was very good.
So you never really had a fear of taking a filly and putting them up. Obviously, what you did in the Kentucky Derby indicates that you never had a fear of putting a filly in with the boys.
Well, if you look at racing in Europe, the fillies beat the boys quite regularly at very high levels. And over there, the reason is that there's not many high-level races for older mares. So you've got to run them against the colts. And every once in a while, you come up with a filly that's tough enough to go up against the colts. It doesn't happen often. But some of them are very tough, and it doesn't make any difference where you run them. They're tough to beat.
Now, in 1980, when you decided to put Genuine Risk into the Derby, did you get a lot of pressure, a lot of feedback?
Well, at first, when we ran her in the Wood Memorial, that was her first race against Colt. And she had won, 5, 6, 7 races in a row before that. And she got beat. She got beat about a length and a half. And to be very honest, the horses that beat her, I thought were kind of ordinary horses. They were young 3-year-old stake horses, but they were not overpowering horses. So anyway, when she was coming back after the race, she was down on the racetrack, and she came back and she was blowing hard, tired, covered with dirt. And I really thought at that moment that we probably should not run her in the Derby, because she was a wonderful competitor against the fillies, but it looked like maybe the colts were a little bit too tough. So Bert and Diana Firestone, they loved the Derby more than anything. They had a dog named Derby. And they wanted to run, and we argued back and forth over it for a couple of days. So we made a deal that we would take her out and gallop her at Belmont on, I guess it was Tuesday morning or something, after the Wood Memorial, and see how she was. And if she was really good, recovered well, why, we would run her in the Derby. So anyway, they flew up from Virginia, and Jacinto Vasquez got on her and galloped her. And it was one of those cold, crisp mornings in New York in the spring, and she tried to run off with him. She was feeling so good. So basically, she told us it wasn't a matter of me making a change of mind and a great choice. The horse changed our mind for us, at least for me. And we went down to the Derby, and it was one of those things that was almost a fate in that some of the other horses came there and didn't train well. A couple of them dropped out of the race. And it looked like it was just one of those things where she was supposed to win. And she did.
And she did, and she was the first filly to do so in 65 years. Going to the paddock that day, how did you feel? I mean, was it different pressure than you normally feel?
Well, anytime you're running a horse in the Derby, it's a big pressure thing. And, you know, you got kind of got the world looking over your shoulder. And as we approached the Derby, as we got closer to the Derby, she seemed to get better. And everybody else kind of was having, you know, a few little problems. So I think our confidence level got better as on Thursday or Friday than it had been on the previous weekend. And, you know, she was a fragile-looking filly, but was actually very rugged. She's the only filly that ever got through all three Triple Crown races.
Now, and, you know, she's probably one of the five horses I admire most. Matter of fact, if you come to our house, right over our mantelpiece is a Anthony Alonso painting of her. And the reason I hang it there is because she was so game. From an outsider's perspective, she's one of those horses that seemed to do anything you asked her to do.
She, every time you ran her, she gave everything she had. And, you know, it's unusual that she could get through the Triple Crown races because they're fairly close together. There's not a lot of recovery time. But with that in mind, you just couldn't train her. You had to run her and train her very, very lightly. But she was dead game, and every time you ran her, she came to play. She gave it all she had.
A lot of your horses are that way, though. Leroy, you know, I remember watching horses, well, Gulch in particular, and same with Manila. Some of Manila's races on the grass, the United Nations, for example, were just, you know, you don't know how he wins the race.
Well, he was an amazingly good horse. And I thought the race that he ran in the Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita was the best field of horses that I ever ran in a race. There were like five horses that had been champions in six, seven different countries around the world. And he was only a three-year-old. And he ran. That was a huge race. You know, we had, I'm trying to think of his name now, the horse that was the champion in England and was a tremendous horse. They thought he was the best horse in 250 years. And, of course, he had run in the Ark, and he won the Ark very easily and shipped out to Santa Anita, and there's a huge difference in the weather. And Santa Anita was very, very warm. So I think that probably took something away from it. But nevertheless, it was really a tremendous field of horses, and that might have been the toughest race that any of my horses ever won.
And he just seemed to just want to do it for you every time you put him out there.
Well, again, he was the horse that we didn't run him often. You know, he once he got well established as a stake horse, we didn't run him, you know, very much. But he was an extremely good horse, very well bred for the grass. And sometimes he broke his maiden a mile and an eighth on the dirt, and won by many. And there are times when I look back and I think, you know, maybe I should have tried him again on the dirt. But anyway, we didn't do it, and that's kind of the way it went.
Well, you did great with him. And then, you know, you'd look at some of the other horses that you had, obviously Gulch, Track Baron, you know, completely different style type of horses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Manila was a come-from-behind on the grass, and Track Baron was an unusual horse in that he wanted to take the lead on the dirt going a distance ground. And that's a tough thing to do, but he was a very, very good horse. as a two-year-old, we took him down to run him in the sapling, and he broke his foot, and we had to lay him up. So he pretty much missed, you know, the early part. Well, he completely missed his early part of his three-year-old year. And I don't think he ever really got credit for being as good a horse as he was. He was, you know, to have a broken foot and then come back and win $1.5 million was a pretty good accomplishment.
Yeah, and he was, to borrow a current term, he was a tough hombre out there.
Yeah, he was a good horse. Tough to deal with.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of a credit and a testament to what you've done over the years with your horses, to go from kind of the left side of the ledger to the right side to the middle, you know, and bring these horses to the winner's circle at a very high level. Now, tell me a little bit about what you're doing and how the family's doing and what's going on with Leroy. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing these days and how the family is and what's going on with Leroy.
My kids are all scattered around. My daughter is a H&R officer for a pharmaceutical company, and she lives in Boca Raton, Florida. And my oldest son, Lee, lives not far from Belmont Park. He's got a horse there at Belmont, and he delivers horses all over the world. Spends a lot of time flying. My younger son, he spends most of his time in Saratoga, and then the wintertime he comes down to Florida. And he sets up meetings for Morgan Stanley and does all kinds of lighting and music and stuff. So he's in San Francisco right now. And anyway, everybody seems to be happy and doing well. And I'm here in Ocala for the winter. I go up to Saratoga in the summer. And we've got five horses here. And, you know, they've got some two-year-olds that I like, but at this time of the year, everybody's got a two-year-old they like.
Yeah, but that's what gives you the reason to get up in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can't, I think you can't give up. You got to keep going, and as long as you've got some horses to deal with every day, I think it keeps you happy and healthy, and that's my life.
You know, it's a great life, and, you know, the last time I saw you, and I have to tell you this, I didn't get a chance to talk to you. You were at Saratoga at the National Racing Museum, and you were speaking to a bunch of folks, and you were so enthusiastic, and the people were so spellbound by you. You're a great ambassador for the sport.
Well, thank you. It's a great sport. I think, you know, people really probably don't have the understanding of what huge, great athletes these horses are. What they do is not easy. It's very tough. And they're the only athlete that I know of that competes with about 12.5% or 15% of their body weight on their back. You know, you take the other human athletes and take 15% of their weight and put it on their back extra, and I don't think they would be as great an athlete as they are. They'd be good, but it would slow them down.
You know, that's a great point. I never really thought of it in those terms.
Well, it's very, very tough. And you go out on the dirt track and put your sneakers on and try to run a 16th of a mile, and you will be so exhausted that you think you're going to lay down and die. So these horses are extremely fit and very, very tough, very competitive, and they are absolutely wonderful athletes.
One of the great things about this interview, Leroy, is listening to the enthusiasm that you have not only about the racing but about the horses, and that's great. You know, if everybody had that, we'd have a great world and a great industry.
Well, I don't have a tremendous amount to do these days, so you kind of look at what's going on in the world. I tell you, if every little kid in the world was as well cared for as these racehorses, it would be a great world.
That's very true. And you're on top of everything. Yeah, whenever we talk, you are on top of just about every subject. Do you spend a lot of time reading, or?
Oh, I read. I read a lot. I read about 60, 70 books a year. Every day, I read two or three newspapers. So I think it keeps you going. You got to be well informed and try to keep up with things.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope your sister's doing better. She's not well, but you and your family, I wish you all the best, and we'll be talking to you soon and probably see you up in Ocala in a couple of weeks.
All right, Al, anytime.
Thanks a lot. That was Hall of Fame trainer Leroy Jolly, and we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with another Hall of Fame trainer.
Now, I'm a man who's known for his pleasures. These two I train. And this one I drink, light beer from Miller. It's got a third less calories than their regular beer, and it's less filling. But what I love best is the way it tastes. What a pleasure. Right, guys? Am I a trainer, or am I a trainer?
Light beer from Miller. Everything you always wanted in a beer, and less.
City slow breaks alertly, and 49er is moving right with him. Wap White is out for the early lead now, and Cutlass Reality on the outside. Ali Sheba come out fifth, and as they pass beneath the twin spires for the first time, it's the gray New Englander Wap White with a short lead. Slough City Slough is running right with them early. They're moving at a lively pace now. They've opened up 5 lengths on Cutlass Reality third. Ali Sheba is off the rail racing fourth. Then farther back, 49er has been taken back in fifth position. And the two Phipps color bearers are running together, seeking a gold and personal flag. Then a gap of 4 lengths back to Crypto Clearance, who's allowed to settle in an early gallop. Lively One trails the classic field as they make their way into the backstretch. Wap White pressed all the way by Slough City Slough. Those two continue as a speed duel continues on down the backstretch. Cutlass Reality is 5 lengths off them in third. It's another 4 to Ali Sheba now, who is 8 lengths off the lead. And just to his inside, 49er now. Julie Crone asking him for run a half mile out. And now the field moving for the far turn. It is Wap White now beginning to shake loose from Slough City Slough. Cutlass Reality is moving in closer third. Ali Sheba begins the roll now. He's making his move as they round the far turn. And then Personal Flag and Seeking the Gold are both moving together now as they come to the top of the stretch. Crypto Clearance is kicking in now, and he's moving into contention. He's just 5 lengths off the lead. Then it's Lively One. 49er is now the trailer as the field comes to the top of the stretch. It is Cutlass Reality and Wap White. Ali Sheba set down for the drive. Personal Flag is moving through an opening turn. Seeking the Gold on the outside. They're coming to the final furlong. Wap White is tenacious. Ali Sheba is right there. And on the outside, Seeking the Gold. Ali Sheba with a short lead. He's unyielding. Seeking the Gold. A final move as they come to the wire. And Ali Sheba, America's horse, has done it. Ali Sheba returns to the site of his greatest victory. And he does it here again at Churchill Downs. Ali Sheba wins the world's richest horse race, and he's now the world's richest horse.
They continue on. It's Fight Over showing the way by half a length. Taylor Special on the outside. Gate Dancer closing along the rail. Swale in fourth place. Down along the inside. Play On now fifth. The outside, Raja Shark. They turn for home. Fight Over has the lead. Up on the outside, it's Gate Dancer coming on. They come through the lane. 3/16 of a mile to run. Gate Dancer has the lead. Along the inside, Fight Over in second place. They come through the lane. 1/8 of a mile to run. Gate Dancer showing the way. Fight Over on the outside, along the rail. Play On coming on with a rush. Here, come on down to the wire. And it's Gate Dancer showing the way by 2 lengths.
And that was Gate Dancer. And the trainer of Gate Dancer is the immortal Jack Van Berg. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. You know, we just had Leroy Jolly on the show a couple of minutes ago. And actually, Leroy was born in Little Rock, and you're sitting there in Little Rock. And the two of you guys, as I've grown up in the industry, you guys have been kind of role models for me for two different types of reasons. Jack, you know, years ago, I bought a horse out of one of your sales called Jack's Big Boss. I don't know if you recall him.
Yeah.
Yep. And I was having difficulty with him. And I called you up, and you spent about a half an hour telling me what I needed to do. And I won two races back-to-back right after that. But more importantly, one night we were in Atlantic City at the old Caesars Hotel. And you, Woody, and Charlie Whittingham, and Bill Shoemaker were there. And I was there along with a good friend, Phil Gleaves. And I just sat and I listened to the three of you in particular, you, Woody, and Charlie talk. And yeah. I had just got my trainer's license. And, man, I carried a lot of that with me for the last 30-some-odd years. And I appreciate all you've done for the sport and, you know, and continue to do.
Well, I feel this way. I had the best teacher in the world, my father. He was a genius with horses, and he was a perfectionist with horses. And the horse come first, and he always said, let the horse tell you what he wants to do. Don't rush him. And if you don't give him time, he'll make you take time. And I just thank the Lord every day that I come up under him, and I felt like I would be a complete loss if I didn't help other people and teach them some of the things that I learned through the years. So I've always tried to help people, and people to this day call me up and ask me about a horse, and I can tell them over the phone 85-90% of the time what to do with the horse, and it turns them around. So I just and I love horses. I love the people. I love the sport. It's the greatest sport there is. And I come from the old school. And the horse comes first, and you take care of them. Hay, oats, and water, and they'll perform for you if you take care of them.
You know, I'm listening to you talking. A while back, somebody said, how would you describe Jack Van Berg? And I said, well, if there could be a cross between Santa Claus and John Wayne, you'd get Jack Van Berg.
Well, in California, they always call me John Wayne. But the only thing that discouraged me was when he died, they didn't call me for taking his part in the movies. So, but his wife, Pilar, she painted a picture of John Wayne, a big one, great big picture of John Wayne, and gave it to me. And put down the bottom from one legend to another. She's a very great artist. And she painted that picture for me and put it down at the bottom from one legend to another, and I cherished that thing.
I bet you do, because you were a big fan of him, of his movies as well, right?
Right. Yeah, I got every one of his movies. I got every one of them.
So. You and I both. Yeah. Hey, you know, you mentioned Dad. Marion, you know, legendary horse trainer, horse trader. Yeah. All around guy that knew the business.
Right.
How was it like growing up under his shed row?
Well, the best way to put it is an old man trained around here for many years called Jimmy Eckrosh. And Jimmy used to come up to me and pinch me on the cheek. And he said, Jack, he said, I thought your dad was trying to kill you all the time working you so hard. My dad taught me work ethics. But we might run 4 or 5 horses a daytime, and the nighttime when he was ready to go to home, he'd decide he wanted to ship a couple horses somewhere, and I'd drive the truck all night long. And I got a little smarter than most people because it's 900 miles from our home in Columbus, Nebraska to Detroit, Michigan, over them two-lane highways. And I'd get in at 5 o'clock after driving 32 hours, and you'd have to work right alongside everybody, so I used to sleep outside of town until they got done training at 10 o'clock and then come in, so I did smarten up a little bit. But my dad would make you work, and if he told you to rub a leg 15 minutes, he didn't mean 13 or 14, he meant 15 minutes, and he was a perfectionist that way. And you know, he respected him so much. Hell, I was married and had 3 kids, and I would never smoke in front of my dad, and I got done auctioneering one day and walked in the office that night, and he was standing there. I thought he'd already went to the house, and I just put that cigarette out in my hand. I never even felt it burn me. So he just had a bearing on everybody, you know.
But you had such a tremendous respect for him, and I know that as you've grown in the business and when you were winning with Ali Sheba and Gate Dancer. He was on your shoulder the whole time, it seemed.
Oh, yeah. When Jim McKay interviewed me in the winner's circle up on the podium at the Kentucky Derby, and he mentioned my dad, I broke down and cried right there in front of the old damn country. So it he just I have a lot of respect for him and my mother. She was a great person, and they say behind every good man is a good woman. She was great. She was great. If she told you somebody was no good, trust me, they were no good. She was a very good judge of character. And she let Dad train and do what he wanted to. If she didn't do something he liked, he run Rose's gym one day for claim. That horse would become the richest Nebraska bred. We raised him and bred him, and he run him for claim at Sportsman Park. And I'll never forget, she said, if somebody claims that horse, if you're so cheap, you got to run him for claim. Somebody claims him, don't come back. There's no bed for you to sleep in tonight. Horse wins, set a track record that afternoon. Nobody claimed him. But Dad was sweating, I'll tell you that.
That's right. He was thinking about sleeping in the car, right?
Right, yeah.
Hey, now, he ran a larger operation in those days, right? You had a bunch of horses under the shed row when he was training.
Well, we might have 40 horses or 50 horses when he was training, and then when I growed up and got going and I had to go to New Orleans, and my dad's assistant, Bob Irwin, was sick, and my dad was sick at the same time. And then we started having split outfits. Him and Bob would be one place, and I would be at another place. But then after my dad passed away, that's when I started having four, five, six outfits at different places. And back in those days, you had to be at one of them racetracks once every week, or they wouldn't let you be trainer. So I was on an airplane every night, every other night, most of the time.
Well, you used to fly yourself, right?
Pardon?
You used to fly yourself, right?
That was when I was buying cattle. I was flying a Cessna 182, then I flew a Cessna 210, then I flew a Beechcraft Bonanza, and then a Baron, twin-engine Baron. But that's when I was flying in Colorado and Texas and Oklahoma and South Dakota, North Dakota, flying to sales, buying cattle. I never did fly to the racetracks.
If they ever put one of those odometers on you to measure how many miles a man traveled, you may have the land record.
Well, I'll put it this way. I probably got more hours of sleep in an airplane than most people have in a bed. In my day, they flew them planes at night. Nowadays, you can't travel at night like you used to, you know.
Right.
They don't go at night. Back in the old days, them planes carried the mail at night everywhere, so you could fly from anywhere at nighttime if you wanted to go. So
you mentioned that you've flown more nights in a plane. You probably won more races than most people have brushed their teeth. You've won now almost 6,500 races, right?
Well, I won more than that because I had my boys after I set that record. I let them boys be down as trainer, Billy Mott and Frankie Brothers, when I still had the outfit. So the first year, I let them get the credit for the wins, and then I win races before they kept track of them, too. So I probably won over 7,000 races with me training.
Jack, that's an incredible number. And the more incredible part about it is how passionate you still are about the game.
Well, I love the game, and I love... my dad was a claiming trainer, turned a lot of horses into stake horses. I've done the same. And there ain't nothing more satisfactory as a claim horse off of somebody. Be able to fix his feet, fix his teeth, get him eating good, get him built back up again, and let him improve. That's the most satisfaction there is, because I love them horses, but... My dad, when he'd come in, he'd be training horses, he'd come in to check on me when I was a kid. And they come to that paddock, if they didn't have a good look in their eye, a bright look in their eye, you know, he'd look in their eye, you would catch only hell. So he could look at them. And he had that stroke. I bought a horse for a couple of miles in New Orleans, and he'd had that stroke and couldn't talk after that stroke, only say a couple of words. And I bought a horse, led him over to have the boy go get him, bleed him over the barn, and at 51 stall barn in New Orleans. He come around the corner and my dad standing there because we had to kind of hold him up. He pointed to take that horse out. That horse never had a pimple on his legs, but he seen him come around that corner and take a funny step. He made me get around that foot, get the digging on it, and he had a punch pocket.
Well, he had a keen eye. You know, guys like that, and you're like that, though, you know, because I've seen you at tracks where I've been, and you can spot things. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, I don't think you can teach that.
Well, I've taught a lot of boys. I got Wayne Catalano, Frankie Brothers, Billy Mott, Billy Gong, Joe Petalino. I taught them boys, but and they've been very successful. But I was gifted with a talent to spot things the same as my father was, and he taught me. But you got to have a little gift with it, you know, to do that. And I thank God every day that I've got that talent and to see things. But there's things that I do, and when you teach these guys, they sometimes forget them, you know. They forget. And I have them come ask me all the time now, boys at work for me. They come ask me all the time about a horse and what this is. So,
Is it because every race mattered to you? Because, you know, coming from a family that wasn't super duper wealthy, every race mattered to put food on the table. And does that still kind of sit in your head?
Well, I trained, but see, my dad owned all the horses that we had. He owned all of them. But I trained for people, and I'd take care of their money and train for them just like it was my own horse and my own money. I just don't believe in just going to a sale and buying a $300,000-$500,000 horse and take him and tear him up before he has a chance. A lot of them horses, it's like I say, kids come to freshman year in high school where I went from the farm and they couldn't tie their shoelaces. And after a couple of years, they developed in football and they'd knock your socks off junior and senior year, you know. And you see people that went through high school just average, and then they go on to college, go to a small college, and they become a star. Horses are the same way. Every horse don't develop the same way. You got to give them time. And as my dad always said, if you don't give them time, they'll make you take time. So you got to give them, and I feel this way, if you don't get the best out of every individual that you come in contact with, then you're not a good horse trainer. That's all I can tell you. And you're going to have horses chip their knee or crack a cannon bone or chip an ankle. But if you try to work them on it when the track is good and the track is safe and the track is the deepest and take your time with them. But here at these racetracks, the minute they open the track in the morning when it's hard as the hubs of hell, they'll be working their horses. Then they wonder why they sore up and have things happen to them, you know? So.
You know, as I was getting ready for the interview, I started looking at, you know, some of the horses you've trained and, you know, kind of some things that you've done. One of the things that jumped out at me is with your claiming horses, how long you can keep them going. You know, where some guys may get to the end of the bar so pretty quickly, you know, you're able to stretch that out quite a bit. And, is that because you look at them so individually or?
Well, we take care of them and figure out what's wrong with them. But nowadays, these young trainers, they want to claim a horse for $20,000. The next thing you know, they got him in for $10,000. They don't care about somebody's money, you know. And if I had a guy working for me and did that, he'd be fired the next day. You know what I mean? When I claim a horse, I have to see something in him that I think I can change and move him up. That's when I claim one. And as my dad always said, when they run them, they're half of their starts are 1, 2, 3. That's an Indian sign. He always said that was the Indian sign claiming horses. If half of their starts are 1, 2, 3, you know, and that's the way we claim. But I claim a horse with the hope that I move him up. I don't worry about dropping him down. These guys nowadays, that don't, well, you see them claiming 30,000-40,000, they're in for 20,000-15,000 the next start, you know.
No, and it's true. I got started a little bit later than you, but when we got early in our careers, you know, you'd look at a horse, and you'd need to move him up, you know, because you couldn't jam him, right. Like these boys are doing it today. And again, in those days, you had to run him every 10 days to 2 weeks for the owner to make some money. You couldn't sit on the shelf for 30 days.
That's still true to this day. But they medicate these horses so much, that's why they can't run them back. And it's just like you. If you're not fit and you go do something, if you go play a game of football or touch football or something, and you're not dead fit, it knocks you out for a week or 10 days. You could store it up and stuff. But if you're dead fit and go play that, it don't bother you a bit. You can play it the next day. I run a horse in New Orleans, Mike Fred, on a Thursday, and he wins. I run him back in a stake on a Saturday. He set a track record. But when they medicate them so much nowadays, running these horses, they got to take a while before they can run them back.
Well, earlier you mentioned hay, oats, and water, and you know, that's how we both came up in the business. But that's changed quite a bit.
It's changed an awful lot, yes, awful lot.
So how do you compete? Because you're doing real well. I mean, the last 6 to 8 months, you guys have been doing really, really well. How do you do
it? Well, I've got some good owners. I'm going to go over a minute. I got some good owners. I got some very good owners. They let me claim some nice horses, and they brought me some good horses to run, and they don't tell you that they got to run them. Take your time, do what you want with them, and that makes a big difference. And when you can buy them better horses, and you know, got a chance to claim one when you see them, well, it makes a heck of a lot of difference. And when to California, when I was having trouble with that ranch where they like to ruin my life, and I should have had a ton of money, should have had 30, 40, 50 million. They sold the water rights for 33 million they stole from me. But, and I didn't have nothing when I come from California. I was busted. I ain't afraid to tell somebody that. I was lucky to have money to eat on when I left California. So, lucky I had some good friends that helped me out and got me going again. And now I've got the new owners, Jerry Groom and Mike Pulich and Mike Waters and Green Walk and Toby Keith, and them people give me some nice horses to train. And I'm very appreciative of it, and I take care of their horses just like if I owned them myself.
Jack, it seems like, you know, when you came out of California, you were focused on getting back, not necessarily to, you know, where you were, but getting back so people realize what a great horseman you are.
Well, I had to get out of California because they didn't give me any horse to train. They thought when he got old like this, the same as Charlie Whittingham, when he got old out there, they took all their horse away from him. In California, if you're not one of them young bucks that do the texting and Twitter and all that stuff, I don't do none of that. If I can't talk to you face-to-face or over the telephone, I don't do no business with you because I'm not going to text somebody. I don't like all this modern stuff. You got to talk to somebody and look them in the eye when you tell them something.
Well, you're still a handshake guy, Yeah, that's unusual these days.
Yeah, well, I was raised that way, and I got cheated a lot with that handshake nowadays. So, but I got good people now, and I got back, and I left California. I had two congestive heart failures and fighting that ranch. You know, I about give up. And the little gal sang the Zinata song, wrote the Zinata song, Liza G. She kept pushing me and said, "You got too much talent to get down. Just keep going." And she pushed me. She said, "You're going to win another Derby." So she got me going again. And my daughter in Denver got me to Jewish Hospital. They got me halfway straightened out. So I got a great assistant. He's been with me since he's 15 and a half. And he takes care of me and the horses just like I did for my own father. So we got a beautiful stable.
How many kids do you have?
I make children. I have 5 children. My oldest and youngest are boys, and I got 3 girls in the middle.
Any of them in the business?
Well, they both train horses, but Tommy's little boy had leukemia, so he had to quit the track because his wife's insurance took care of everything. She brings all the conventions in Louisville, so Tommy does them raggeds and cheats. Tim's in California. He trained a stable for me out there, but he likes mechanics better than anything. Well, he was a very good horseman. They're both good horsemen, but you know, kids nowadays don't like 7 days a week. It's hard to...
If you can get them to work 5 days, you're lucky.
That's exactly right. My dad... You know, work in half days. You just worked half days with my dad. Any 12 hours you wanted.
Exactly. Now, how about your girls? What are they doing?
I got one girl in Denver. She's got 4 daughters. I got another girl. Denver's got two boys and two girls. And I got my middle, that's my youngest out there, oldest. My middle daughter's in Owensboro, Kentucky. She works for an outfit. Now, she growed up with horses and can train horses as good as anybody. She was with me all the time. She can put a better bandage on when she was 11 years old than any groom you ever seen.
So you got a full house on Christmas, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, but I got a Samuel Almarez. He takes care of me just like I took care of my dad.
And like you said, he's been with you for forever and ever.
He's been with me since he's 15 now. I've been with me 38 years. He shoes the horse and does everything.
And how are you feeling? You feeling pretty good?
I'm all right. I was supposed to get a new knee. They didn't do that. Then I was supposed to get that invasive on the back. Didn't get that. And I have a little trouble breathing, catching my air. But I got a scooter I run around the racetrack on in the afternoon. It's really good.
Well, I can't tell you how much it means to me for you to spend the time with us. You know,
well, thank you.
I wish you absolutely the best of luck. And hope to talk with you many times up here in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Okay.
Take care, Jack. And that wraps up another episode on Equisport News. We'll look forward to seeing you back in a couple of weeks. And, Scott, you've been amazingly silent.
I know. I'm getting ready for the Fountain of Youth at Gulfstream on Saturday.
Okay.
$400,000.
I'm breaking my back doing this radio show, and he's handicapping a race. Anyhow, that's it for us here at Sunshine Meadows in Delray Beach. And we look forward to seeing you back on the network. Thanks a lot.
Here's Bearcat. Here they come, spinning out of the turn. Dancers, Bearcat puts a head in front. TK Skipper fights back down along the rail, and they slug it out. TK Skipper has the lead along the rail. Dancers, Bearcat, second. Freight Saver to the outside in third. Kurtz first, down along the rail, fourth. Down the stretch, inside the furlong marker. TK Skipper about to win another. Freight Saver on the outside, and along the rail, Rare Storm. But it's TK Skipper again. Another fine performance. TK Skipper by 2.5. Freight Saver second, Rare Storm third.